You're joining the cycling podcast in the Alps at the 2025 Tour de France, and our coverage of the race is brought to you in association with Wahoo. Now, if you want to pedal like Ben Healy, and let's face it, who doesn't, perhaps you should get yourself a set of Speedplay Aero pedals from Wahoo. If you're looking for the extra edge on your ride, the Speedplay Aero pedals are built to cut through the wind and help you ride faster with less effort. Plus, you can fine-tune your cleat position down to the smallest detail, so you get a setup that's just right for you, and that in turn is easier on your ankles, knees and hips. So ride like Ben Healy, get some Speedplay Aero pedals, and go to wahoofitness.com for more. Now, on with the cycling podcast.
This is the cycling podcast at the 2025 Tour de France with Lionel Burney, Graham Wilgos and friends, brought to you in association with Wahoo. Today, we're in Courchevel, Col de la Loze.
Oh, so good! So good! Can I go in the car?
Yeah. Just there. You and Maro.
I was just strolling for Benno. I mean, he's showing some amazing legs. And days like this, I don't know what about a ski resort in horrible weather. It was hailing on the way up. Ben just seems to love it. He always gets the biggest and hardest wins when the weather's horrible and everyone else is struggling. So I think it's such a credit to who he is as a person and how hard he works. And he makes it hard on himself, but it's such a reward.
Well, Lionel, that was the celebrations of Luke Plapp, two in two episodes that we started the cycling podcast with some sort of celebration. No singing today, but Luke Plapp, Jayco Alula, of course, celebrating his teammate Ben O'Connor's win with a trademark bold and brave solo attack on perhaps the hardest climb and certainly the most grueling stage of the race, the Queen stage.
Yeah, absolutely. The highest finish of the race, the highest point of the race. And for Ben O'Connor, another high in his kind of love-hate relationship with the Tour de France, which we'll talk about a little bit later on. But a really, really impressive stage win for Ben O'Connor. Very well thought out from start to finish and saw it through on the Col de la Loze, which is a difficult climb, as we all know.
I mean, I was up there. We'll get into that too. And it was brutal. And it's one of the most brutal stages of the Tour de France that I can remember. Tadej Pogacar, early mention for him too, because he has laid rest to a few ghosts today on the climb where he fell away going mano on mano with Jonas Vingegaard a couple of years ago, 2023. Also an early mention for Oscar Onley, because what a ride from him. He closes in on the podium. We will get into that too. Before we do, where are we?
Well, we're down in Les Alouettes, which is a little village in sight of Courchevel, really, isn't it? Courchevel is kind of like one long town going uphill, stretching up and up and up to the Altiport, really. And we're in a quite a busy bar. It's a what night of the week is it, Graham?
I think it's Thursday, I think, but I'm not the most reliable witness.
Excellent.
At this point.
Thursday, good. And we've got ourselves a beer. I think a pizza is on the way. I love a mountain pizza, I must admit. You've already had your pizza. Let's not talk about.
We did save you some tonight, though.
Well, where is it?
Where? It's on the bar. They've taken it away.
No, I think Simon's eaten it. He's rubbing his stomach. So
photographer Simon Gill.
So you went back to the team car, you got me a musette, and then you gobbled it before you'd even got back to the peloton.
The good news is tonight that more is available. Shall we get on with the tale of the attack? Because it was a big one, and it was a thrilling one. It didn't disappoint, but it didn't necessarily go the way we thought it would. It more or less went to plan, but there was a surprise winner.
Well, it was one of those days where it was always going to be in the balance between the breakaway and the GC riders. And there's some reasons why it didn't all come back together for the GC riders. But it was a very, very big day out. The Queen stage, as you say, going over the Col de Glandon, the Col de la Madeleine, and then up to the Col de la Loze. And the first news of the day that we got was that Carlos Rodriguez of Ineos Grenadiers, lying 10th overall this morning, he is out of the race, non-starter today, because he came down in that crash a kilometre from the finish yesterday in Valence, and he has fractured his pelvis. So a painful exit from the Tour for Rodriguez. And the early business was the intermediate sprint, wasn't it? And Lidl Trek kept it all together, as we expected they would, for Jonathan Milan, who got 20 points, crucial 20 points. And then it was a case of who was going to get in the break and how many riders would make the sort of final selection as they went over first the Glandon and then the Madeleine.
So we saw, I'm going to fast forward to 81 kilometres to go, when we saw Aaronsman for Ineos and Matteo Jorgensen out front for Visma Lisa bike. They had about 3 minutes on the peloton at that point. The Primoz Roglic group for Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe just behind them. Then we saw Wout van Aert take off for Visma Lisa bike. He took 40 seconds off the Roglic group in very, very short order. And so it was a case of, were we expecting Jonas Vingegaard to go from long range and perhaps try and put some time into Tadej Pogacar early and try and sort of stretch the elastic to the point that it snapped? I mean, it's very similar tactics to what we saw with Simon Yates and Wout van Aert in the Giro. That didn't happen.
No, but I think the key thing was that the breakaway had a lot of power in it, but it also had well-placed riders on GC. Primoz Roglic, you mentioned. This was in the kind of the final selection of 14, really, which was the real meat of the break. Primoz Roglic, of course, well inside the top 10. He was in there. Felix Gall also going for a top 10 finish. He was in there with his teammate Bruno Armerai of Decathlon Agir d'Azur. But then horsepower in there. Aaronsman, who has won a stage already. Jorgensen, as you mentioned, Tim Wellens was in there, policeman for UAE Team Emirates, really. And then the other rider that kind of interested me was Alexei Lutsenko, because he'd had a relatively quiet tour. Riders that we knew could get up the road and then would have a chance, even on a steep climb. But it was Ben O'Connor who, well, he rode very kind of conservatively. He just followed, really, until the group started to split down. I think it split next into seven, and he made that split. And then it was over the Madeleine and on the descent that he revealed in the press conference that he had a chat with Matt Heyman in the team car at that point, Jayco Alula, sports director, and they had a conversation about, right, how do we win from here? And they decided that they had to go from pretty much the bottom of the valley and try and get up the road, element of surprise, obviously, and then basically time trial it to the top of the Col de la Loze. And that was what it was, really. It was kind of a mass start time trial from the sort of midpoint in the stage. But there was so much else going on that it was one of the, you know, real edge of the seat days, where if I went to the bathroom or I went to the buffet to have some lunch, and when I came back, the whole complexion of the race had changed.
Yeah, it almost felt like it kind of those few groups on the road, the handful of groups on the road, almost kept switching out. But we had the battle for the stage. We also had the battle for the GC. We had the battle for the podium too, between Florian Lipowitz and Oscar Onley. And at one stage, I think Florian Lipowitz had 3 minutes maybe on Picnic Post-NL's Oscar Onley.
Yeah, but before then, he'd been in completely the wrong position, off the back, chasing. Mm. And I couldn't work out quite how that had happened. It was one of those strange things where, is that bad legs or bad positioning or just caught inattentive at the wrong time? Or had he tried to get a feed at the wrong time? But he was chasing hard. And then, before you knew it, he was back in front of the GC group and gaining time on the first two and sort of cementing his place on the podium. But did he overextend himself? Because as we look at the GC tonight, Lipowitz is now only 22 seconds, only 22 seconds, only 22 seconds ahead of Oscar Onley. I won't labour that one anymore.
I think you're allowed, and I think Oscar Onley has earned it. But it was the foot of the climb, really, when Ben O'Connor started to stretch his legs. The yellow jersey group was catching at that point, but O'Connor just seemed to get out and sustain the gap. And in fact, he started to streak away and put more time into the yellow jersey group in the first few kilometres of the climb. That was the point that Visma Lisa bike seemed to go to work. Simon Yates and Sepp Kuss on the front working for Jonas Vingegaard. You still had Florian Lipowitz sort of going off the front of that second group, hanging in there. But he was the whole time O'Connor seemed to be sustaining the pace. Lipowitz seemed to be sliding further back towards the yellow jersey. But O'Connor kind of managed to keep the gap, and he rode further away from Ina Rubio, who was then second man on the road.
Well, the solo move he made was about 16, 17K to go on the final climb. But it happened before that, on right at the start of the Valley Road, really, about 41 maybe to go. O'Connor, he kind of lifted the pace through a bit of a nothingy bit of road, a little kind of S-bend. It's not quite downhill, but certainly not uphill. It was a weird little move, really, but it was clearly the strategy. Aina Rubio of Movistar reacted, and then Matteo Jorgensen of Visma Lisabike reacted. And again, in the press conference afterwards, O'Connor said that the ideal strategy or the ideal outcome was that when he moved, Jorgensen would go with, and so that they would have kind of a powerful alliance. Knowing that, there'd be not much interest in particularly Vingegaard sort of chasing up from behind, because at that point they were still thinking, will that GC group come back? I mean, it wasn't close in the end, but if it had really kicked off in that GC group, it might have been a factor. So well thought out by O'Connor, and when he got to the line, he still had a minute and 45 over a raging Tadej Pogacar, who matched everything that Jonas Vingegaard could throw at him and then picked him off at the end. And Visma Lisabike did try, though, didn't they? Sepkus did a big turn. Simon Yates was there at a certain point. You know, Jorgensen was up the road as well. But again, Pogacar just has an answer to absolutely everything.
He did, and he had Adam Yates and Jonathan Narváez working for him on the front. Narváez for his punch, and Adam Yates was just able to tempo him up to the point where he was ready to launch in the final few kilometres. Also worth mention for Team Picnic post NL, who came steaming through like a train with Oscar Onley on the back at the bottom of the climb too, to put him back into contention with that GC group.
Yeah, because he'd lost ground as well, hadn't he? And so was coming back on, and you know, crucial work by teammates. And this battle for third place now is really alive, and will be very exciting tomorrow on the way to La Palagne. But a big stage win for Ben O'Connor, the second Tour de France stage win of his career. His first came in his debut tour in 2021 at Tiene, when he entered the rest day at second place overall that year, and then kind of slipped back a bit, but ended up fourth overall. A very impressive debut at the Tour de France. And I think we've been kind of waiting for him to back that performance up. And as he said in the press conference again, he's had terrible luck. The opening days of the Tour de France are not his friend. In 2022, he crashed on stage two in Copenhagen, and eventually pulled out of the race midway through as a result of just struggling on for 8 days. And he crashed on stage one here in the final 5 kilometres of the opening day. Pretty badly banged up, but he's recovered well and obviously taken his chance today. But he said, you know, crashing twice through no fault of his own and wrecking a previous tour, he thought the same thing was going to happen, but he saw it through today. And it was a great, great win. As I say, 1:45 ahead of Pogacar, who stretched his overall advantage a little bit more. Vingegaard was 9 seconds behind him. Then came Onley. Then came Aina Rubio, Felix Gall, Primoz Roglic, Adam Yates, Tobias Halland-Johannessen, and Sepp Kuss rounding out the top 10. Crucially, Florian Lipovits was 11th, 3:37 behind Ben O'Connor. Kevin Vauclin was 12th, and the other GC rider from the top 10, Ben Healy, was 17th, 9:28 behind the winner. So overall, there's only actually two changes in the top 10. Felix Gall jumps above Vauclin into 6th, and Ben O'Connor is up to 10th as a result of Carlos Rodriguez's withdrawal this morning. But like I say, that battle for the podium now, very, very close. But the man of the day, Ben O'Connor, and I think you spoke to his sports director, Steve Cummings, at the finish.
I did, on the way back to Simon Gill, the photographer's van, which I was very grateful once again to get into, this time because of the absolutely filthy weather. I mean, it was hailing at the top of the climb at one point. I ran past one of the Jayco Alula cars and sort of scampered back because I thought I saw our man Steve Cummings in there. It was him. Very pleased to see him. I should also preface this interview with the fact that it was cannonballed very briefly by friend of the podcast, Adam Blythe.
Well done, Steve. Phenomenal stuff, mate.
Well, I didn't really do anything. I'm a taxi driver. I'm the Uber.
What's that going to do for the team?
It's great, isn't it? That's what every team wants, I think. What can I say? To be honest, I think we really deserve it. The team's been amazing. They've been in every group possible. We missed one day. Yeah, it's just super, isn't it? It's just super. There's just... I don't know. It's... what we needed.
Chances were running out.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Great, Will got something. Is that like... Bloody Graham!
I'm going to have to go because you've got to take these boys down. But,
down!
We're going that way, yeah.
Oh, my.
Oh, just clear the way, get your motorman down there.
Steve, well done. Oh, one more quick one for you. What does it mean to Ben?
He deserves it, doesn't he? He's like, it's typical, like, in his characteristics, you might describe him as a persister, and he was exactly that. He did the perfect stage. He entered the break really smooth, smart, and then he had big balls to attack when probably no one else would in the valley, and then it finally he's just so strong as well, so he deserves it, because that crash hit him pretty hard, to be honest, and brilliant, yeah.
Well done, mate. Yeah, yeah. Thank you.
Thanks again to Steve for climbing out of the car to talk as he was putting Luke Plapp's bike on the roof. And Adam Blythe, well, it was good to see you in slightly unusual circumstances.
Did you get on the telly?
No, I didn't. Oh.
Never mind.
Next time. So, Steve Cummings mentioned the fact that Ben O'Connor had crashed early in the race too. And it sort of mentioned, it sort of said that it was a classic Ben O'Connor win and he did it in only the style that he could and kind of echoed Luke Plapp's sentiment that kind of picked the hardest day and went hard and went long.
Yeah, and bear in mind, this is his first year with Jayco Alula after several years with the AG2R, now Decathlon AG2R team. And he said he was really enjoying himself in the team, mixing in a kind of English-speaking environment, I guess. But... He didn't say that it was a bad thing to be in a French team, but he definitely gave the impression that he was feeling very comfortable in the team and also felt a sense of relief, I think, that he had managed to deliver a big win in the Tour de France. We should probably throw to Matt White, our tactical guru here. Of course, sports director at Jayco Alula until May, just before the Giro, and was quite involved in the transfer of Ben O'Connor to the team over the winter. And I wanted to know from Matt three things, really. One, what was Florian Lipovic doing? You know, why was he behind and then ahead and then behind again? But he started off by talking about Ben O'Connor and how he pulled off that major victory.
The Queen stage has been run and won. What an intriguing day it was. And there was races within races there. Finally pulled off by Ben O'Connor. And a brilliant move, actually. Brilliant move to first make the big split of the day. And then the timing of his attack in the valley there, when he could see that the two leaders, the two big stars of our Tour de France were watching each other, he knew that he needed time before the final climb because he knows he couldn't go head-to-head with those guys. So perfect timing to go away with the movie star rider and Jorgensen. And he had just enough time to hold off a fast-chasing Tadej Pogačar. So big win for Ben, big win for Jayco Alula. And then the other story of the day was our intriguing battle for the final spot on the podium. Now, Lipovic looked very, very strong today. And unfortunately for him, got caught in between groups at the wrong time on a couple of times and then tried a solo move as well. But the problem was he probably spent the most time out of any rider in the bunch in the wind. And ended up paying for it on the hardest day of the Tour de France. Now, that has now narrowed the gap between Oscar Onley to only 22 seconds. Oscar Onley at one stage was 2 to 3 minutes behind Lipovic. And in the end of the day, pulled out a big chunk of time on him across the finish line. Who got the tactics right? Well, I think Oscar Onley didn't panic. I think he had a big benefit of a couple of teammates came back in the valley. Vandenbroek, Barguil. They came back and made a big difference on the approach to the final climb. And at the end of the day, he had the best legs on the final ascent to put himself in very good position for a life-changing experience with a possibility of arriving on the podium of the Tour de France.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
As ever, great to hear from Whitey. Point on Roglic and Lipowitz, who were, well, they animated the race for much, if not all, of the day. Primoz Roglic was still hanging on in that final GC group, yo-yoing back and forth a few times, but still hanging on in there. It felt to me, though, Lionel, that even though they're riding for the same team, Red Bull, Bora Hansgrohe, didn't feel like they were riding together. They were just two normal men who happened to be riding in the same colours, but they certainly weren't. There was no communication, and it was just a case of whomever had the strongest legs today was going to hang on until the end. But there wasn't any cohesion.
Yeah, normally at this stage in the race, you see teams cooperate to protect a GC position, don't you? Florian Lipowitz is the man holding third place. He's a young rider, and he's obviously a very big talent. Primoz Roglic is kind of the old timer. He's been around the block. He's won Grand Tours, multiple Grand Tours, very experienced. I don't know whether it's realistic to expect Roglic to kind of babysit Lipowitz through a day like today, because if Lipowitz had blown, which could have happened on the final climb, or at any point really, early in the day, especially when he was behind, you wouldn't sacrifice Roglic's chances of being the best bet for the podium. So you wouldn't sacrifice, you know, an experienced rider who probably has got the horsepower and the engine to see this through. There's still another big day to go up to La Plana, and Roglic is only, what is that, 1:48 off Lipowitz. And we see this with younger riders at the Tour de France every year. Sometimes it's a case of one day too far. So they wouldn't want to necessarily compromise Roglic's chances in the event that Lipowitz, I don't want to say fell apart, but in the event of him having a difficult time. So I can kind of understand them having their own free rein to do their own thing, rather than, you know, Roglic trying to, you know, like I say, nurse him through to the finish.
Lipowitz, of course, is still in the young rider's white jersey, but hot on his heels, not just for that, but for the podium. As we mentioned, Oscar Onley. He just keeps getting more and more impressive as the race goes on.
Well, again, there was a point where he was the only rider that can go with Pogacar and Vingegaard. And, you know, we should not take that lightly. I mean, an exceptional performance again today, not just by him, but by the team. No panic either. In the wrong position at a certain point, losing time, but really held it together and treated the whole stage as a whole, rather than thinking, oh, well, out of it now. And again, I've said it a couple of times, but the key on stages like this, especially when it's such a hard final climb, is just keep moving forwards as best you can, because you never know how other riders have maybe misjudged it or gone a bit into the red. And so, you know, he came up to the line there just off the back of Pogacar and Vingegaard, and well ahead of everybody else in the GC group. Exceptional riding by him.
I was in the scrum on the top of the Col de la Loze to try and get a few words with Oscar Onley. I didn't, but happy to say, press record, well, our colleague Daniel Freeb did.
Oscar, was it a dark moment on the Madeleine, or did you manage to keep your cool and know that you could come back?
Oh, I wouldn't say I kept my cool, but I still felt good. Just, I know the level of those guys when they attack. And I think it showed at the end that they went pretty hard up there.
The team did a great job for you.
Yeah, they were really good.
You're 22 seconds from the podium now. I mean, you must be excited, Oscar, going to the last mountain stage.
Yeah. I don't know. That's not much. So we'll give it everything tomorrow.
Thanks, guys.
Okay.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Just to highlight the kind of chaos of the day, really, Graham. Enric Mas was a non-finisher, and yet early in the stage he was up the road in groups, moving away. And I thought, well, he's come up short in the mountains on the big one, Mont Ventoux, when he was looking great with a few kilometres to go and got reeled back in. Just an exceptional day of unpredictability, really. And just, like I said at the start, this sense that they were all just trying to get to the line as quickly as possible. There was almost no cohesion between any of the riders or any of the teams. And Enric Mas there, getting in a move early on and then not making it to the finish. A disappointing end to the Tour de France for him and Movistar, who are, despite Ina Rubio's ride today, are seriously misfiring, underperforming compared to what we have expected from them in the past.
It was chaotic on the top of the Col de la Loze as well at the finish. Because it was raining and hailing so hard, everyone gets their waterproofs on. No one is necessarily in the right place. You get a few fans mingling with the press. They tend to keep the TV separate from the podcasters, from the traditional written press too. But everyone ends up kind of mingling together, and then you're told, well, you shouldn't be here. A couple of colleagues from Cycling Weekly and Relais were marched out of an area that they were asked to leave, an area they weren't supposed to be in. I was marched out of the TV bit, but kept my pass, I'm happy to say. Oscar Onley, in amongst all of that, I mean, I don't know if this came across in the interview, but he looked and sounded exhausted, and you almost wanted to sort of put an arm around him. He still, I mean, the riders still had to, they still had to descend 6Ks back to the team buses, although, as Luke Plapp at the top of the episode said or made clear, he was getting in the car along with at least one other teammate. It was on the road, it was shifting everywhere, quite chaotic in terms of the formation of the race. On top of the climb at the finish, utter chaos. You could barely tell who was who, and it felt like riders were popping up everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to break it to you, Graham, but the Tour de France can be quite hard some days, can't it, for everyone? But I think when you look at the results, right, so only 18... So 18th place, Santiago Buitrago, was the last rider to get within 10 minutes of the winner. And then the gaps open up massively. And by the time you get down to 35th place, it's over half an hour. And then by the time you get to the gruppetto, well, there wasn't really a gruppetto. It really was twos and threes, threes and fours. No significantly big group, even right back in sort of 45 minutes down. And I'm sure there was a little bit of concern about the time cut. I think they got in comfortably in the end, about 6 minutes, was it?
Correct. I actually spoke to Jake Stewart on my way down to Simon the photographer's van. He had a word on what it was like at the back end of the race.
How ridiculous was that, Jake?
6 minutes inside time cut. It's, hard day. Yeah.
Were you getting a little bit nervous at the end there, time cut wise?
No, not really. I think, it was with the green jersey. I think a few guys were getting a bit twitchy, but we know how this game works. So, yeah, got through safe.
Well done, mate. You live to fight another day.
Thank you, that's for sure.
So Jake Stewart confirming there, Lionel, 6 minutes, quite comfortable in the end. A couple of guys in their bunch getting a little bit twitchy, but they were with the green jersey. As good an indication as any, really, that things were going to be all right. They were going to get in under the wire.
Yeah, I mean, Jake Stewart actually nudged ahead of the green jersey group by a few minutes, but that's probably because the final sections are so steep, and once they knew they were going to make it, it's about saving legs, isn't it? But when you look at the results, the biggest group out the back was probably only about eight riders, no gruppetto, and I can't remember many stages like that in the Tour de France. Normally there's a big group at the back of the race, 40-50 riders sometimes, but not like that today. A real tough day.
Tadej Pogacar was probably already on the podium. He'd done with his podium duties by that stage. I'm going to reintroduce, if I may, Gilliver's Travels at this point.
Excellent.
Because in conversation with Simon on the way back down the mountain, he took a few photos of Pog on the podium, and he said that what stood out was the fact that Pogacar celebrated like he'd put a few ghosts to bed, and that it almost felt like, well, that was part one of his celebration, kind of eyes closed, head tilted back, arms aloft, you know, and that it was he's so used to being on the podium, and we're so used to seeing him kind of, you know, collect the accolades and the bouquet, etc., and it's a kind of business as usual sort of thing. Today it was not anything like that. It was markedly different, and his celebration kind of gave his emotions away, and, you know, put those ghosts to bed. Kind of felt like he might have won the Tour today, or he felt like he'd won the Tour today.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was the first question he was asked in the press conference. Did he feel like he'd laid some ghosts to rest from the collapse on the Col de la Loze a couple of years ago? He said yes, he did. You know, he's super happy with how they rode today, but he did say it is not over yet. There's one more big day to go. He actually said there's 3 days left, so I'm going to try my best tomorrow and the day after and the day after. And he is counting the kilometres to Paris. You don't often hear riders admit that. Maybe just giving an answer to the press. It doesn't necessarily indicate a sort of deep state of mind. But he looked tired. He did look quite tired. I mean, they always look more tired when it's cold and they're wrapped up. He's wearing the beanie hat and the jacket. But he did say, I can't wait until it's over. I try to enjoy every day on the bike as much as I can, even though it's very hard. I'm tired. I'm annoyed by more or less everyone around me. And you want to go home. But the crowds on the climbs give you something. And if you have good legs, it makes everything quite good. I think we can all empathise with that sentiment, can't we? Everybody around us annoying us. Or maybe just me and Pog. I don't know. Probably the only thing I've got in common with him at this point. But he said about the race, because they had a hard day, actually. And he said that Vingegaard attacking on the Madeleine meant that they kind of had to rip up their tactics a bit. And he had to go with. And that meant that it was quite hard to then go for the stage. It was all about containment, sort of throw a fire blanket over it, dampen down what Visma Lisabike were trying to do. And at this point, he says, I'd love to win stages. And he referenced Mont Ventoux as well. He said, but the priority is just to defend the jersey.
It was a marking job for him again today, a man-marking job. I think Visma Lisabike, and I've seen a little bit of criticism for them already, but I think Visma Lisabike deserve a bit of credit for trying something.
Yeah. You know, we often criticise teams for just riding around and settling for what they've got in the final week, and they're not doing that. It's not their fault that they're not able to come up with something that's going to rock Pogacar. I mean, who knows? Maybe tomorrow, but it's such a big lead. They're only going to dent it, if that, and I can't even see that, to be honest.
No sign of the aforementioned, yesterday's arrogance from Pogacar today.
No, he looked too tired to be arrogant, to be honest. But we shall see. I mean, you know, there's still a fair bit of racing to do. But I think he will... Yeah, he's so pragmatic, isn't he? He races when he needs to and wants to. But also he knows that there's no time to be reckless in the Tour de France. It's just about getting the job done now.
I'll tell you another man who's famed for his pragmatism. So much so that we've got people writing in to ask him for the answers to some very important questions.
Absolutely. Is it time for any other Bosness?
Absolutely.
Excellent. This is courtesy of our title sponsors, Wahoo, and we have a question for Ian. And this question is a simple one, actually, and it relates to the cycle computers that Wahoo make. Other companies make cycle computers as well. But this question is, what are the riders looking at on their bike computers when they are racing in the Tour de France? And that question comes from Riley. And this is Ian's answer.
Hey Riley, very timely question given the recent blog done by Michael Woods during this year's tour. I am a big fan of riding with a bike computer, regardless of where or what I'm doing. And in the World Tour, yes, every rider has a bike computer on their bike. This is really important for collecting data from the stage, but more importantly, most riders have their bike computers set to the map page. This is something that I learned in 2015. I was in a descent in the Vuelta, and I was behind Michał Kwiatkowski, and he was flying down this hill. And after the stage, he said, of course, he's a much better descender than I am, but I was so curious as how he knew what was coming. And that was the first time that I realized he was using a GPX file on the bike computer to follow the GPX route down the hill, so he knew what was coming ahead of him despite not being able to see a lead car or a motorbike. So most riders are, yes, looking at the map page. They can put some data fields up at the top, whether they want to see power, heart rate, speed, distance to a queue. Oftentimes now teams are putting in queues into GPX files so they know when the aid stations and feed stations are coming up. So that's a key point for riders to also be reminded of eating, drinking. You can set all sorts of little alarms on your bike computers in this day and age every 20 minutes to pop up and say, hey, eat, drink, or climb coming up. It's become very customizable. Personally, I don't think it's a huge distraction. If anything, it's a tool to help keep riders safer to know what's coming up, because there's no way anyone can actually remember all the roads over the course of a Tour de France.
Wahoo have got a Tour de France and Tour de France Fam sale, which is running whilst the tour is concluding and through next week when the Tour de France Fam is on. It runs until Monday the 4th of August. It's available to listeners in the EU and the UK, and you can make savings up to €800 or £700 across both outdoor and indoor cycling products. Check wahoofitness.com for details and get yourself a great bargain on some of their kit and equipment.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
L'étape de demain, le dîner d'hier. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's dinner.
Last night's dinner, Lionel.
Classic.
I don't know, dinner's doing a lot of heavy lifting here.
We dithered around, Graham, and we ran right up to the time limit. I mean, we were 6 minutes inside the time limit, weren't we?
Just, yeah.
We ended up in
got what we deserved for it too.
We ended up in a sort of cafeteria type place. I had a burger, which was fine, but the salad had come straight from a very cold fridge, so it was a real weird experience.
I had a microwave meal that was served in, well, a slightly more presentable It was ravioli with the thickest blue cheese sauce. Ravioli straight out of the freezer in the thickest blue cheese sauce I've ever chewed through. And I didn't finish. No. I DNF'd my dinner.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't a classic, was it? We've not done too well the last few days, but there we go. It was better than a missed dinner, but only just.
And I know what you really want to talk about.
Well, we went back to the hotel, didn't we? And a young man from the UK over in France on business got chatting to him, and we ended up playing pool. We'd moved away from the pool table so it didn't disrupt our recording session. We didn't want the clacking of balls, but we had a great game of pool, and I think I saw evidence of a misspent youth there, Graham. I'm not too bad with a pool cue.
Oh, thank you very much. But I was going to say exactly the same thing about you. And our listeners can judge for themselves on your Instagram, Simon Gill's Instagram, and the Cycling Podcast Instagram. So somebody was quite proud of one of his shots, wasn't he?
Somebody posted it three times. I don't know why. We played a game called Killer, which I have to say, I've played Killer at darts, but I've never played it on a pool table.
You didn't know the rules. Who's never played Killer before?
Look, I was a very serious young man. When I played pool in a pub as a teenager and in my early 20s, I liked to play best of 35 frames.
So we should probably do the scores on the doors of this, because Luke, the fourth man to our party, came away with two wins from Killer, and I came away with one.
And did we play four games? Or three games?
I thought it was three. I might have sort of blacked out for a bit. I don't know.
I think I had shot of the night. That will do me. But yeah, it ended up being quite a pleasant evening, didn't it? Actually, very nice to just have a little bit of downtime, unwind, do something slightly different to covering the Tour de France and working. It was nice.
Indeed.
It was back to business this morning, though, wasn't it? We had a busy one, and I kind of had my eyes off the race a little bit because I've been working on this Kilometre Zero episode for a few days about Dave Brailsford's comeback to Team Ineos and this story that has kind of been haunting them since the start about the head carer of the team, David Rosman. And, well, it's been like nailing jelly to a wall, this story, to be perfectly honest. And there was a significant development this afternoon when I was in the press room working on the final episode, because Ineos Grenadiers released a statement, a longer statement. And, I mean, it's kind of thrown the whole story wide open, really, as far as I can tell. So I'm not going to read the whole statement. It's in the Kilometre Zero episode, which is out now. Some people may already have listened to it. It's on the free feed, so everyone can hear it. And it's kind of, it's a sort of story of two halves, really. It's about Dave Brailsford's return to the cycling team at the Tour de France, the scene of his greatest glories, 7 Tour wins in 8 years, as we know. Then the difficult experience working at Manchester United Football Club, another part of Jim Ratcliffe's sporting empire. And then he's kind of slightly sort of moved back to the cycling team after not a terribly successful time at Manchester United. And then this story about David Rosman has blown up on the eve of the tour. Now, earlier on in the tour, Dave Brailsford told me that he wouldn't be commenting at all on the situation. It relates to these text messages allegedly sent between David Rosman and Dr. Mark Schmidt, who was already a doctor linked to a doping scandal at the Gerolsteiner team in 2008, and then subsequently was jailed and served at least a couple of years of a nearly five-year sentence for doping practices. So it's murky, it's unclear, there are questions to answer. And until today, really, Ineos Grenadiers have given the impression that they don't have anything to say about this. So the previous statement given said that they had not been presented with any evidence by a formal body. Today's statement is slightly different. It says that team member David Rosman was informally contacted in April 2025 by the International Testing Agency STAR, who asked him about these alleged historical communications. Now, it then goes on to say that although David was not under investigation, Ineos promptly commissioned a thorough review by an external law firm. So everything we've been told throughout this tour, which is, well, what are the allegations? We don't know. We're nothing to kind of see here. All of a sudden, it turns out that back in April, Rosman was contacted informally. And at that point, Ineos launched an external investigation with a law firm. I mean, an extraordinary development, really.
Now, a bit of a non sequitur, if not completely contradictory.
Well, there's some information that was definitely omitted when we all went and asked Brailsford and Team Ineos about this situation. It was kind of like brushed away, and now it turns out that maybe there was something to say a week or so ago. Now, we understand David Rosman has left the Tour de France. I believe it was on the rest day in Montpellier, but I'm not 100% sure about that. He certainly hasn't been at the Tour for several days. And now he's been invited to have a formal conversation with the International Testing Agency. And because there's now a kind of formal investigation, Team Ineos are saying that they cannot comment any further. Unsatisfactory, really. My episode kind of meanders here and there. It features a conversation with David Walsh about why this matters, what it means for Team Sky's legacy. Chris Froome's tour wins are kind of dragged into all of this because Rosman was Froome's carer, you know, kind of his personal carer during those years. And it's just a rattling of skeletons from the previous era, and it adds to a list of things that have not been satisfactorily explained, not just to the media, but also to official investigations by the British government and the UK Anti-Doping Agency. Dave Brailsford is very good at kind of swerving the issue, and I'm not sure on this one that he should. If it can be easily explained away, they should do it. They should come out and say exactly what happened. Are those text messages genuinely between Rosman and Dr. Mark Schmidt? What did they mean? And if they can come out and say there is nothing here, well, let's hear that too. But this kind of grey area that we find ourselves in is not great. Anyway, the Kilometre Zero is online now. People can listen to that and make up their own minds, I guess.
The timing is extraordinary with Brailsford's return. On to timing of a slightly different, more celebratory sort, and an anniversary, one of the several anniversaries that this tour seems to have heralded.
My birthday.
Your 50th birthday.
I'm actually a few days younger than the polka dot jersey, because I think the tour started in very late June in 1975 when they introduced the polka dot jersey. Earlier in the episode, we didn't talk about how that competition's going in the tour. Lenny Martinez, of course, was leading this morning, looking resplendent in his polka dot socks. Oh. He went over the Glandon first and hoovered up some points there, but because there were significantly more points available on the Col de la Loze at the finish line, Tadej Pogacar is now leading on 105 points, ahead of Vingegaard on 89, and then Martinez is back on 72. There are 60 points available tomorrow, and then Saturday and Sunday they're just 13 available over those two stages. So tomorrow it will be decided. And I suppose the Tour de France has got a situation where at least the best climbers in the race are first and second. The best climbers in the world are first and second in the classification, because there has been criticism in the past that the polka dot jersey is kind of awarded to the best attacker, the best breakaway rider in the mountains, rather than the best climber. Now, Graham, if you will permit me, I'll give you a bit of a history lesson on the polka dot jersey. It's one of the most recognisable jerseys in world cycling, isn't it? It's probably more recognisable than the yellow jersey because it's so distinctive. The maillot à pois rouge, red peas.
And the most, I mean, the most popular bit of merch thrown out from the caravan are the polka dot t-shirts and the polka dot bucket hats, aren't they? I mean, so that's possibly part of the reason why it's so recognisable. But the reason it began...
Well, let's hear from François Thomazeau about the origins of the polka dot jersey. Like lots of things in cycling, sort of lost in the mists of time.
So, like many other things in the history of cycling and especially the Tour de France, the origins of the polka dot jersey are the subject of not controversy, but uncertainty. For many, many years, it was believed that the polka dots came from the wrappings of chocolate bars by the first sponsor of the polka dot jersey. That was the Poulain chocolates. And I can testify personally that when I was a kid, there was the chocolat Poulain. I used to eat chocolat Poulain like many kids. And the wrappings actually had dots and they had a kind of polka dots. It was not red dots on a white surface. It was more like silver and red. It might be it might be true, but then in recent years another theory has appeared, which is also quite possible, and maybe it's a mix of both. And the other story is there was a track rider, a French track rider, before World War II, in the 1930s and 1940s, called Henri Lemoine. And he made a reputation for himself as the polka dot rider, or more true to the to facts and the nickname, the man with the peas, because in French le maillot à pois means the jersey with the peas, well, the peas you eat, green peas, and actually when Lemoine, in the days of 6 days cycling and track and everything, you had to be different to be noticed. And apparently Henri Lemoine, to be noticed, decided to have polka dot jersey, and a white jersey with red dots. And he had a partner called Marcel Grimbertier, I think, and he was they were pairing in 6 days races, and then this guy had a white jersey with blue dots. Anyways, Félix Lévitan, who would later be the director of the Tour de France, he knew Henri Lemoine well. He organized 6 days races, and he knew how popular Henri Lemoine was. Lemoine, you know, rode in his polka dot jersey all over the planet in 6 days races all over Europe and even Australia and the US. And he may have been influenced by the polka dot jersey of Henri Lemoine when he decided in 1975 to reward the best climber of Tour de France with a distinctive jersey, and he chose the polka dot as the color. And was it reminiscent of Henri Lemoine, or was it because the main sponsor Chocolat Poulain had polka dot wrappings? Who knows?
We call it the King of the Mountains. The French don't call it the King of the Mountains, Le Roi des Montagnes, or whatever that would translate as. The competition is called the Meilleur Grimpeur, the best climber. And like I say, we can debate whether it's the best climber or just the person who targets the points. But the competition has been going since 1933, but it wasn't until 1975 that they created this distinctive jersey. And as François has explained, it could have been because of the chocolate wrappers, or it could have been because a six-day rider was inspired by a jockey, the jockey's silks. We don't quite know, but it's been much copied across loads of other races. Mm. And when it was first introduced in 1975, it really divided opinion. Lucien Van Impe, the Belgian rider, one of the best climbers in the world at the time, and the man who would eventually win the jersey in Paris that year, he completely dismissed it as a clownish costume and said that if he was leading the competition, he would refuse to wear it. He thought it was a joke. But that was until he saw how the crowds reacted to it, interestingly. The crowds loved it.
Lenny Martinez is doing... well, he's doing the Lord's work in that sense, isn't he? Doing it all sorts of favours. You don't agree with the full-on polka dots from head to toe, particularly the socks.
Back in 1975, they wouldn't have had matching shorts and socks. But the jersey was first up for grabs on the second day of the 1975 tour. There'd been a prologue the previous day, and then on the second day, there was a short road stage in the morning from Charleroi to Molenbeek in Belgium. And the following stage in the afternoon was going to go over the cobbles of Roubaix. Now, there was only one categorised climb on the route, a very small one called the Côte de Bommière, and that came after 5 kilometres. It was short, not particularly steep, but the first rider to the top would get the honour of wearing this first novelty jersey. And Joep Zoetemelk, whose father-in-law worked on the race, you'd think there would be a grand unveiling of this amazing new jersey. There really wasn't. But Zoetemelk saw it and thought, I want to be the first guy to wear that. He attacked. Eddy Merckx tried to beat him to the line but couldn't, so Zoetemelk wore the polka dot jersey for the first ever time, ironically, on a cobbled stage. I mean, the mind's blown, isn't it?
I've got a quiz for you.
Go on.
It's the rider with the most King of the Mountains title wins. Who's won the polka dot jersey the most?
Well, Richard Virenque, because he was never stripped of the ones that he might possibly have been stripped of. I can't think why.
Correct.
Can you name any of the other sponsors of the jersey? After Poulain, the chocolate company, there was Campagnolo, Coca-Cola, and for the past 30 years, it's been 3 supermarkets, Champion, Carrefour, and now Leclerc.
Carrefour and Leclerc. I could have told you anything else. I'd have been scraping the bottom of the supermarket trolley, I'm afraid to say.
Now, you know, Leclerc, they started sponsoring it in 2019, and the boss of Leclerc is a gentleman that we've met. I think he's France's 3rd richest man. Francois kind of knows him, and we met him at Leviscos once, Kel Surprise, and he explained, because I've complained about the Leclerc jersey, they've straightened all the dots up. It used to be kind of haphazard dots. They've made them much smaller, and they're now in rows. They look like a game of Connect Four, if you remember that from your childhood, and I don't like that. I normally like common sense and order, and I'm a bit of a neat freak about
certain things.
Bit of
a rogue when it comes to the King of the Mountains.
But he explained that he wanted the iconic jersey, but he wanted it to be, he wanted to put their own spin on it and have something that they could own. Mm. And I suppose in that way it is effective. What else can we say about the King of the Mountain jersey other than it's only really in recent years that the Tour de France winner has been in with a shout of winning it, with Froome, Pogacar a couple of times, and Vingegaard. Carlos Sastre, when he won the Tour in 2008, also won the King of the Mountain title, but that was only because Bernard Cole was stripped of the King of the Mountain title for doping. But there we are. That's a little history lesson on the Dotti jersey, the one my daughter loves the most.
It's good to swat up. any other business this time? A bit of housekeeping, I think.
Yeah, just a couple of things, Graham. The Tour de France Fam starts on Saturday, and the team have released their preview episode. It's online now, so if you're going to be following the Tour de France Fam, and why wouldn't you be, with our daily episode, of course, but also watching it on TV, get across all of the detail in our preview. And as I mentioned, that kilometre zero about Dave Brailsford, Team Ineos, and the ghost from the past is also online now. And I think tomorrow morning we'll put out our camping expedition on Mont Ventoux. Now that everyone knows we survived it, we can release that.
One wild night on Mont Ventoux.
Yes.
Well, I think that pretty much wraps us up. A less wild night ahead. One more big day to go. Anything could happen, but unlikely to.
Well, we'll see, won't we? Jonas Vingegaard has not won a stage. So, you know, there's big climbs on the way to La Plagne, and we will see whether that is the switch of their focus for Visma Lisabike, because let's face it, not going to claw back 4 and whatever it is minutes. So maybe they will go all out to try and win the stage at the top of La Plagne, having gone over the Corme de Roseland. And what's that one before?
Cordesese first. The first Cat 1 climb of the day. Then we've got the Col de Prey. Then the Corme de Roseland Cat 2 climb. And then we swoop down into the valley for the final ascent to La Plaine, the HC climb at 7.2%.
Yeah, I mean, the Cormier de Roseland is a hard climb. Average. The reason it's second category is because it's basically they're turning off the road after the Col de Pre and then up over the Cormier de Roseland. So, I mean, that is a lot of climbing in the middle of the stage and then a bit of recovery time before the final rise up to the line. And we will be there tomorrow, Graham.
Almost 4,700 metres tomorrow, 5,600 today. But looking forward to getting up one more mountain before Paris.
10,000 metres climbed in 2 days.
Savage, isn't it?
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb and Lionel Byrne.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at lower.com field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at columbuscrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.